Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 161, and what's this I hear? The sound of wind whipping and howling through the mountain recesses, these snow-capped mountains, where the rivers have torn deep ravines in the geography, terra physics, scraping rocks, rushing waters plunging from the escarpment into the Eastern Cape and the Free State, foaming and roiling. It must be the home of the Basutu. Many South Africans make the fatal mistake of thinking that Lesotho is such a small place, reliant on its big neighbour. It's basically another province of the RSA. My friends, harbouring that misconception will get you in deep trouble. It's not size that matters, it's pure unbridled pride. Moshoeshoe and his descendants have fought long and hard for independence, albeit in a nation surrounded by a single other nation. The only other entities that have this unusual character is the Vatican City and San Marino, both enclaved by Italy. Semi-enclaves exist. There are many examples. Perhaps the most problematic is the Kaliningrad Oblast, which is Russian territory and has a coastline, but it's dominated by Poland to the south and Lithuania to the north and east. Lesotho is a very special case in world history, as you're going to hear. By the mid-1840s, Moshoeshoe had turned to the British authorities, and their policies were more favourable to him than those of the Boers. The British, at least at this point, showed no sign of coveting his land, nor had they ill-treated his people, unlike what they'd done to the Amaxhosa to the south. Moshoeshoe was being kept up to date about diplomatic events by the influential French missionary Eugène Cassali. By 1843, the Paris missionaries had realized that the biggest threat to Moshoeshoe and his Basutu were not the English, despite the bad blood between the French and the English, but the Trek Boers. As you heard last episode, trekkers like Jan Mok were particularly aggressive. He believed in his people's inalienable right to take over all the land of what he regarded as heathens. So for Cassali and other French missionaries, converting their Basutu flock to Christianity seemed more and more urgent. The Trek Boers took a liking in particular to the extremely good soils around the mission stations of Betuli and Besheba. What had increased the complexity about who owned or lived on what land in this area was the fact that African herders and farmers speaking dialects of what colonial linguists would later call the Sotho Tswana and other Nguni language groups were present in the Upper Orange Valley by the 16th century. The Bakwena chieftaincies that would forge both resident and refugee clans into the Basutu nation were arriving from the north by the 18th century. Both they and the Afrikaners who arrived from the southwest in the early 19th century acknowledged the presence of the people they called Barwa, who were Sesotho, and the San, who had been foraging in this region for thousands of years before anyone else pitched up. The San were subjected to both Boer and Basutu raiding, with the latter usually killing all the men and seizing the women to marry and the children for work. The Basutu regarded the San as dangerous neighbours who required pacification through absorption. The Trek Boers regarded the San as the original owners of Transorangia, then promptly set about exterminating them. This is so important because the Boers didn't see the Basutu as the original owners of the land. They saw the owners as San. In the years of discussions, letters, meetings, official notes, logs, missionary biographies, it became obvious to the Boers that the San were the original owners, and it meant then that the Basutu couldn't really own the land at all. It's quite a matrix puzzle this time in our past. For the Basutu, the land was owned by their kings, even though there were no obvious homesteads on much of the territory across the Orange in the southern reaches of the Caledon Valley, because Moshoeshoe had decreed he owned it in his public pronouncements. For the Boers, as they rolled into this territory, it was pretty empty of people, except for the roving groups of San who didn't farm and had no livestock. They hunted and gathered, like they'd done for eons. Both the Basutu and the Trek Boers lived in mobile and independent agro-pastoral and hunting communities. Both were very different from the San. Or to put it another way, the Basutu and the Trek Boers lived almost identical lives, with very different or divergent notions of the relation between their political and territorial organization. What is remarkable at this stage was how for the past two decades, since the 1820s, the Basutu people's unifying leader, Moshoeshoe, as the founding monarch, was piecing together his mountain kingdom at exactly the same moment as the Boer and Griqua settlements began to spread into this region. Basotho national existence began in the midst of what we'd call settler colonialism, as well as the intra-African wars between rulers like Mzilikazi, Mantatisi, and Shaka. It's remarkable because this is one of the African states that grew out of a response to invasions by brown, black, and white. Sesotho oral tradition speaks of the royal family line of Bakwena ba Mokoteli, which forms the totemic core of Basotho aristocracy and existed way before these invasions. So French missionary Kasali and his colleagues became Mushreshwe's external voice, writing his communications, and despite their patriotism as Frenchmen, they regarded the British in the Cape as their allies. The reason is simple. France had zero interests in southern Africa by now, so this decision to sidle up to the Brits in Cape Town was not a contradiction for the French. And the decisive link between Mushreshwe's missionaries and the colonial government was Dr. John Philip, the South African superintendent of the London Missionary Society. You know him well by now, I'm sure. He'd been closely associated with the Lesotho mission from the start of French involvement, advising the Paris directors to send men like Kasali to South Africa, and he even acted as their financial agent in Cape Town. The paper trail is so important, isn't it? Just when someone forms an opinion about who did what and when, and for some or other reason, along comes the paper trail to blow bias out of the window. When money talks, everyone listens, or something like that. Governor Sir George Napier was also taking a special interest in Mushreshwe, and by now was regarded as a champion of Khoi and Khoisan people inside the colony. Napier had also penned a few vehement letters criticizing the settlers dealing with Amaxhosa and other chiefdoms. By 1844, treaties with Adam Cook II and Mushreshwe were concluded, with the eye-catching line in both agreements, where each of these leaders undertook to be the faithful friend and ally of the colony. You heard last episode about the territory these two ruled and how the boundaries were somewhat hazy. Dr. Philip had travelled here and declared that Mushreshwe claimed all the country between the Orange and the Vaal, east of a drift on the Modo River, 15 miles southwest of Tabanchu. This was not regarded as a valid claim by the Trekboers, nor Mushreshwe's implacable enemy, Sekonyela of the Batlokwa. Dr. Philip admitted that Mushreshwe only really directly controlled the country between the Orange and the Caledon, but when he drew up the territorial provisions, he added a strip from 25 to 30 miles on the northwestern side of the Caledon, except for a little chunk near its source and at its junction with the Orange itself. Talk about confused boundaries. The Cape government, and therefore the British government, immediately recognized Mushreshwe as the ruler of the land in a triangle between the Lower Caledon and the Orange. However, few of his people had ever lived there, and according to the general uncertainty, Trekboers were already there. You can see where this is going. The land on the left bank of the Upper Caledon had been seized by Sekonyela from Mushreshwe in 1824, while the lands on the right bank, where Basotho villages could be seen, were interspersed with the settlements of mixed race or coloureds in the newfangled speak of the time, and these mixed race settlements were being administered by Wesleyan missionaries at Platberg, Letswane, and Mpokwane. That's not all, because this is real history. The treaty did not say exactly what power Mushreshwe could wield over Morocco's Rolong people nearby, nor Taibosh's Kora clans. It was an ambiguous treaty when it came to the status of all these people. They lived almost exactly 30 miles from the Caledon River, therefore adjacent or perhaps even inside Mushreshwe's land. However, they did not think of themselves as Basotho, ruled by Mushreshwe, but as Rolong, ruled by Morocco, and the Kora, ruled by Taibosh. Mushreshwe told Kasali he had a solution, and he informed Cape Governor Napier that as far as he was concerned, he had signed the treaty in good faith, believing it would be amended to extend his boundary to incorporate the Wesleyan mission stations at Tabanchu and Marumetsu. We spent time looking at this for one main reason. For the rest of his life, which extended until 1870, Mushreshwe regarded this treaty as a charter underpinning his territorial claims and his relationship with the British government. He'd negotiate using this treaty and eventually go to war against the Boers and even the British over it. The Voortrekkers were pushing into this region, and from now on the intensity of conflict grew. As the number of trekkers increased, they penetrated deeper and deeper into Griqua and Basotho land and treated most with contempt. The African and Griqua chiefs fought each other at the same time, as well as with the Boers, in a scramble for land, cattle, and even firearms. 2 days after Moshoeshoe signed his treaty, horrified Wesleyan Mission General Secretary William Shaw wrote a letter to Napier protesting on behalf of his society and the chiefs of the Caledon Valley. And so, friends, began a series of claims and counterclaims. Had this been the era of social media, heaven only knows what kind of mis and disinformation would have bounced around the ether like supercharged digital ping-pong balls. Moshoeshoe had a rare gift in the middle of all these ping-pong claims. For the British, he was sovereign of the entire territory, thus vaguely defined. But it was unclear to the very same British if he was indeed sovereign over all the inhabitants. What about Moroka, Davids, Baiki, Taibosh, Sekonyela, and numerous other independent chiefs? None of these accepted Moshoeshoe as overlord, nor did they pay him annual cattle tax as a kind of confirmation of his power. The missionaries representing these various power groups began to squabble, and quite loudly, by 19th century standards. The Wesleyans had spent some time before this expressing admiration for Moshoeshoe and the Paris missionaries. The two societies had met and agreed the biggest threat were the Boers. The missionaries had a tacit understanding that they would not encroach on each other's operations, but didn't agree on what limits existed. After Moshoeshoe's treaty, the relationship broke down. Each society allied itself with the chiefs they represented, but the advantage was Moshoeshoe's. He had a treaty in his hand, a fait accompli. Kasali and Moshoeshoe made a formidable team. The Frenchman was there for the long haul, but his Wesleyan neighbours were not. The Wesleyans rotated or transferred their missionaries from one station to another, which meant they could not build up a proper form of trust and rapport with the chiefs like Moroka and Sekonyela. Kasali and Moshoeshoe seemed to have an honor code that was more egalitarian, could I say, more French. They respected each other. The Wesleyans appeared haughty, distant, talking down. Not all, but this was the general culture of operations. Sometimes Kasali wrote letters on behalf of Moshoeshoe speaking about the king in the third person. Other times he wrote these letters using the first person. These letters were signed by Moshoeshoe's cross. Kasali tried to set himself up as a Basutu royal counselor, one of the many that had Moshoeshoe's ear. In African terms, he was a royal counselor. In European terms, he was the foreign minister. This treaty was going to cause a lot of trouble. The Wesleyans pointed out quite logically and accurately that Moroka, Davids, Baiki, and Taibosh were leaders of independent communities and had settled on land that Moshoeshoe did not occupy, and they had defeated the isolated Basutu villages there. They claimed Moshoeshoe recognized their position as rulers because he did not exact payments for the land. It was true that these independent peoples were in the minority compared to Moshoeshoe's Basutu, but they included the Griqua and coloured settlements. These people could bring more than 2,000 muskets to bear. They possessed 1,500 horses, and most were Christian. These people now demanded their own treaty. Combine the immigrant coloured chiefs or captains together, and another with Sekonyela, just like the British had done with the Griqua chief Adam Cook II and Moshoeshoe. Sounds perfectly reasonable, you'd say. Except it wasn't, really. The big document elephant in the room was James Archbell, who'd somehow persuaded both Sekonyela and Moshoeshoe to sign a document 10 years earlier, which indicated that Sekonyela's people had bought the land around Tabanchu for 7 oxen, 1 heifer, and 2 sheep. By 1840, the document was being roundly condemned as false. Kasali studied all of this, and together with Moshoeshoe concocted another perfectly reasonable response. Before 1818, they declared, the people living in this disputed territory were known as tribes which went under the general name of Basutus, spoke one language, and had the same habits and customs. They intermarried, and they had a common origins story. Then the Lifakani shattered these people's lives, splintered them. They had been forced to the high ground, leaving their valuable land. Now that the Lifakani had ended, Moshoeshoe was once again the ruler of the Basutu because I was the only one who had succeeded in preserving his power and property. The fugitives had returned by thousands from the colony, and thus my title to rule Basutoland rests first on my being born sovereign, wrote Kasali on behalf of Moshoeshoe. And second, on my having become the acknowledged chief by the original proprietors of the remainder. The original proprietors of the land, in other words. Thirdly, he said, When outsiders, strangers, rode into his territory from the northwest in 1833, he'd allotted them lands, but he was still in control of these lands. Lastly, that land was not empty. It was merely vacated, because his people were hiding in the hills in fear of further attacks by the extremely violent Nguni like the Amandebele or the AmaZulu, or the Kaurna and other coloured raiders. So let's sit back for a moment and think about all of this. For a start, by the mid-1840s, the Basutu under Mushoeshoe occupied 69 villages to the northwest of the Caledon, whereas Baiki, Davis and Taibosh only had one small village each. Morocco's Rolong were not much larger, they were concentrated in and around Tabanchu. There's more. Mushoeshoe's Basutu lived in more than 260 villages along the Caledon, and in another 440 villages on the southeast side of the river, with a combined population of close to 50,000 people. Ah, hold on, you say. I thought size didn't matter. Vehemence does. Power does. Well, in this case, Mushoeshoe was pointing out that his people were far more entrenched than these other latecomers to his land. Unfortunately, history is much more opaque than just quoting a number, and I'm saying I'm bigger than you. Kasali and Mushoeshoe had indulged in a little creative accounting. But by delivering these clear points to the British, they had also obfuscated a few choice truths. Shock horror. They distorted a few facts. They distorted the actual control over the land emptied by the Lifakani. The Wesleyans did not have the rapport that Kasali had. They were extremely badly informed about the history of the region, whereas the Frenchman was all about the history. And so for Marocca et al., their storytelling just did not have the clever nuance that Kasali and Mushoeshoe brought to bear. The Wesleyans were not as informed about customs either, and never managed to express Sikonyela's or the views of Morocco, Baiki, Stavid and Taibosh successfully. Kasali and Mushoeshoe convinced the British of their right because both knew how to generate a reasonable argument that bureaucrats could understand. Two other French missionaries based among the Basutu were Thomas Abousse and Constant Gosselin, and they were also busy scribing letters of note to Cape lobbyists. For the Basutu, this period is critical. It was the moment that created an inalienable truth for all Basutus. It was an ideological point where the light of many disputes and comments and stories focuses through a cultural prism, contributing to the incorporation of the diverse inhabitants of Lesotho into one single political community. This was their historical charter, legitimizing the king, the nation, and all the bonds between everyone. It was also at this point, 1844, that Mushoeshoe decided to take a kind of rural ride, checking out his western marches. Shortly afterwards, he sent out a notice that all land negotiations and transactions, as well as all land improvements between the Caledon and Orange Rivers, were unlawful and null and void. The Trekkers ignored this. So too did the Wesleyans. So too did Adam Cook II, it appeared. In 1845, events in Philippolis meant that the Cape officials had to reconsider the implications of all these alliances they'd signed north of the Orange. Adam Cook had failed to restrain other Griqua from selling or leasing land to the Boers in return for firearms, brandy, ammunition, and livestock. Trek Boers in their hundreds were now scattered across the southern Free State region, their numbers bolstered from 1843 by the Boers who left Natal. It was a scramble for land never seen on this scale in the region, and the majority of the Trekkers here were ardent Republicans who openly defied the British and, by default, Adam Cook II. Then in May 1845, Mushoeshoe sent a message to the Cape governor that he was growing concerned about the number of Boers living on his land between these two rivers, saying more than 300 farmers were within his territory. As the events unfolded here, Mushoeshoe was studying the Caledon Orange like a chessboard. He was astute in playing one chief against the other, pushing them out, spreading his power along the river into more and more contested areas. And importantly, Mushoeshoe encouraged his followers to go to work in the Cape and return, but they should not return empty-handed. Oh no, he said they should return with horses and guns and ammunition. Just in case anyone thought he was playing silly games, he set up his own gunpowder magazine at his great place, Tabobusu. An arsenal was being constructed. Kasali, the missionary, was not perturbed by that one little bit. He knew that firepower was going to be crucial in defending the Basutu against incursions by men on horses wielding muskets. It had been the rough division that had been carved into the Upper Caledon between the Batlokwa and the Basutu in the 1820s that led the Basutu to name the river Mohokare between two things, or in the midst of. Today, Sesotho oral tradition speaks of Moshoeshoe having named the river and complaining of a later boundary to be known as the Warden Line. We'll get to that. What is driving all of this is the very idea of the meaning of words. These are weapons we wield that belie our perceptions. In Sesotho, the word for border and boundary, moeli, came about rather late in terms of time, referring to a ploughed furrow, then to a small empty strip used to demarcate fields under cultivation. These features only appeared after the first missionaries arrived, spreading the idea of the metal plough as an agricultural tool. As we'll hear next episode, the first real clash of note involving the peoples of this region and the Trek Boers would see Adam Kok trying to exercise jurisdiction by arresting a Boer who was accused of mistreating Griqua workers. It would also lead to the new governor of the Cape, Sir Peregrine Maitland, who'd arrived in 1844, by the way, trying to define these boundaries more exactly than his predecessor, Sir George Napier. So what happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to upload an update about this episode. You can also email me from there. Until next, Samia Huntley.